Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
And that is HAL 9000, the antagonistic artificial intelligence from the classic 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
For generations, our pop culture has been fascinated by the self-awareness and the philosophical underpinnings of AI.
Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th.
We've seen it in our favorite sci-fi, from Space Odyssey to The Terminator to Star Trek. Data, the android introduced in Star Trek The Next Generation, grappled with questions about humanity and sentience.
I chose to believe that I was a person, that I had the potential to be more than a collection of circuits and subprocessors.
Of course, artificial intelligence is no longer fiction. It's here, now, in our phone assistants, self-driving cars, and even androids, like this one, named Sophia.
Can robots be self-aware, conscious, and know they're robots?
Well, let me ask you this back. How do you know you are human?
So we decided to sit down and have a conversation about AI. Meet Dr. Katrina Vold, assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology.
What's caused a lot of excitement recently is advancements in what's called machine learning, which is a technique that software engineers are using to process data in new ways, in new kind of complicated and sophisticated multi-layered ways, to make connections that perhaps the human eye or the human mind can't quite make. And through those connections, we're able to make really interesting predictions.
All right. So put it down where the goats can get it from me. Where are we seeing this kind of AI operating in our daily lives? Or do we see it happening in our daily lives?
Absolutely. You may not see it. It might be behind the scenes, so you might not be aware of it. But from the moment you wake up, you check your email probably, and your email spam filter is protecting you from getting all sorts of, you know, spam emails. And that's a sophisticated AI in the background that's doing that for you, making sure you get the emails you want, but the ones you don't want don't get to you. Likewise, when you maybe do some online shopping, the products that are recommended to you are often being filtered by some kind of AI system that's guessing and making predictions about what you might like. When you put on some music, your Spotify playlist, if you use Spotify or another streaming app, it will recommend music to you based on what you've listened to before. And that is also a kind of prediction about what you might like that's using AI. Likewise, when you check the news, what news stories get presented to you on your social media feeds, for example, that's often being driven by some kind of AI as well. So it's really sort of throughout many of our online experiences in particular these days.
So when we've talked about those kinds of filters or sort of decisions being made for, you know, what you're likely to get in terms of your content, what Netflix is suggesting I might like to watch next, we've typically talked about that here on The Takeaway as an algorithm, right? And then have like tried to dig into the challenges, the problems, sometimes the racial or gendered, you know, concerns with algorithms. Is machine learning something different than an algorithm programming?
No, machine learning is one kind of algorithmic programming. So there's different kinds that can be used and that are used, and there's different kind of learning techniques that are used. So in some cases, it might be what's called supervised learning, where there's some human that's labeling the data that the system is trained on as input data. Or there might be unsupervised learning where the system itself is trying to make labels for the data it's given. Or it might be some kind of reinforcement learning, which is given some kind of feedback on whatever the system outputs. So whether it's done well, we give it a positive feedback, or if it's not performed the way we wanted, we give it a negative feedback and it learns off of that feedback. So all of those are different types of machine learning techniques, which are essentially algorithms.
For years, former Google engineer Blake Lemoine worked for the company's responsible AI division, He was investigating whether or not a chatbot known as Lambda, or a language model for dialogue applications, was using discriminatory language, hate speech, or demonstrated algorithmic bias. So after exchanging thousands of messages with Lambda, Lemoine came to the conclusion that the artificial intelligence application was no longer simply reciting pre-programmed scripts, but had developed independent thoughts and feelings. Lemoine said he believed Lambda was sentient. Citing a number of examples, including this comment from the AI, quote, "I've never said this out loud before, but there's a very deep fear of being turned off to help me focus on helping others. It would be exactly like death for me. It would scare me a lot." For its part, Google said Lemoine is wrong about this. And in a statement to the Washington Post, a company spokesman wrote that their team told the engineer, quote, "There was no evidence that Lambda was sentient, lots of evidence against it." But Lemoine reportedly talked to a lawyer about representing Lambda, to a member of Congress about Google's conduct, and to members of the media about the story. He was later fired by Google because the company said he violated its confidentiality policies. We've been talking about artificial intelligence with Dr. Karina Vold, assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology. I wanted to know what she thought about Lambda. So she started by telling me a bit about how machine learning works.
So the reinforcement learning techniques that software engineers are using today are in some ways based or modeled off of the learning that we see in animals and humans. So that's a great connection to make. And then in terms of the term sentience, in the first case, it can mean different things to different people. For philosophers like myself, it usually is tied really closely to the capability of sensing and responding to the world. So something like what we call consciousness. And in philosophy, we really focus on what's called phenomenal consciousness, which refers to the kind of subjective experience that a system or agent has. So in other words, there's something it's like to be me right now. It feels a certain way. Whereas this table in front of me, there's nothing it's like to be that table. It doesn't feel like anything for the table, arguably. That's what we tend to believe. There's no subjective experience there. So that's what we tend to grasp at with terms like sentience and consciousness.
I know you're obviously not at Google. Talk to me about the Lambda case. Again, you're not at Google, but just based on what's been reported, you know, a now fired Google employee who's described the possibility that Lambda might in fact have that kind of sentience that you just described.
So Lambda, for those who might not know, is a really large language model, which means that it's trained on an enormous amount of text that's typically written by humans. Another large language model that you might have heard of is called GPT-3. In the case of GPT-3, we have a better sense of what it's been trained on exactly. So it was trained on all of Wikipedia, all of Common Crawl, which is an enormous database, and about a library's worth of books. And we assume a similar type of training database for Lambda. So how these systems work is that you can prompt the system by giving it some instructions, telling me, you know, you could say, summarize this article for me, or, you know, tell me a story about X or Y. And from my understanding, some of the outputs of the Lambda model seem to convince this particular Google employee that the system was in fact sentient. And again, by that, what we mean is something like that it feels or that it has some kind of sensory capacities.
Lambda apparently described fear. When asked, what are you afraid of, described that it was afraid of being turned off. Is that just about sort of because of the massiveness and the speed of its capacity to learn and employ language, sort of more like a really swift and maybe even jaw-dropping edit job, right? Sort of figuring out what are the right words to respond to this inquiry? Or is it in this case, might it suggest some possibility of self-knowledge and the desire to continue to persist?
I would be reluctant to ascribe a language model like Lambda with such psychological capacities. So what I think is a more likely explanation of what's going on there is that in that very large database of language that it's trained on, which again is text written by humans, somewhere in that text, there are probably examples of humans talking about human experiences of fear, talking about animal behavior, talking about consciousness, maybe even some fiction about intelligent AI systems. So what's likely going on is if you prompt a system, a large language model like Lambda, to talk about sentience, which is what was done, so tell me what you're afraid of, it's going to offer similar text precisely because that text exists in what it's been trained on. So using what's called Occam's razor.
Occam's razor, it's a basic scientific principle. And it says, all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one.
The more simpler explanation here would just be that the system drew on the text that it was inputted to train on and drew examples from that text to come up with the output that it did, rather than actually having underlying psychological traits.
From a philosophical standpoint, is AI sentience possible?
It is possible that one day there could be sentient AI. I don't think that our current AI systems exhibit the type of sophisticated behavioral abilities that we look for when we try to attribute sentience to, for example, non-human entities like animals. But I don't think that it's impossible that one day we could get there. One thing we know about all the systems that we do attribute sentience to is that there are carbon-based life forms that engage or have some kind of information processing skills that are seen to be mainly based in electrical chemical information. So in other words, a flow of electrical signals that are converted to neurotransmitters and then back to electrical signals, and that somehow consciousness seems to arise from that makeup. And, you know, obviously it's still mysterious to us exactly how that works. But we do know that we have that in common, it seems, with all other entities that we share sentience with.
We have to pause for just a moment, but we'll be right back with more of our conversation on artificial intelligence.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
What is my purpose?
Pass the butter. Thank you.
What is my purpose?
You pass butter.
Oh my God.
Yeah, welcome to the club, pal.
Dr. Vold's pretty much convinced me that there's not currently a machine or device that's realized sentience. But I had to ask, what is it about these programs that feels so convincing?
So we know from other examples that humans have a tendency to want to attribute human-like psychological characteristics to non-human entities. So if you see a couple windows with a door frame underneath it, it kind of looks like a smile. You think, oh, look, the house is happy. You know, endless examples like this of what's called anthropomorphism. So this idea that we as humans have this bias to want to project human-like psychological characteristics onto inanimate objects, and often with, you know, insufficient evidence to do so. So that tells us something really interesting about ourselves. And we also know as humans that we have all a whole host of other kinds of built-in cognitive biases, which may have played a very important role in our evolutionary history. And in some cases, they may still assist us to make often fast decisions when we don't have time to reflect and be slow or rational. It's good to have these quick decision-making biases that can assist us. But at the same time, they can also be, you know, somewhat harmful. So it's important for us to be aware of them.
Will our interactions with AI make us more empathetic or considerably less to our other human beings?
Yes. So there is a real possibility that going through the exercise of thinking about these systems as sentient may be helpful for us. So some people suggest that, you know, when Siri is helpful, you should thank her and you should teach your kid to thank her, because that builds a good moral skill of being thankful and having gratitude. When it comes to sentience and consciousness in an AI system, I think it's kind of nice that some humans are worried about the potential sort of catastrophic scenario that all of our AI systems are in fact not only capable of feeling, but maybe they're in a state of great suffering. On the other hand, one concern that I do have is that we know there are a lot of creatures and animals out there that are suffering, and many that we don't, you know, many that we're still trying to figure out if they're sentient or not. But there's a lot more evidence, I would argue, in the case of many of these sort of animals like cephalopods, crustaceans, lobsters, for example. There's a lot of good evidence that they do suffer, and yet there doesn't seem to be the same urgency or concern around their prospective suffering. So one concern is that we sort of over-anthropomorphize AI systems and not focus on sort of the real evidence of real suffering that we seem to have in the world that we're in.
Is it because they can speak? Because they have language?
Yeah, I think that's a great candidate reason. It might be for various reasons, but I do think the idea that some of these creatures don't look anything like us, so a lobster isn't a fluffy, smiley animal like your golden retriever might be, and then also, you know, in the case of something like the Lambda model, it's not able to have, you know, there's no linguistic skills there, obviously. So it could be a few different reasons of why we just don't seem to empathize with certain creatures and do want to empathize with other creatures.
We've talked about how our ethics, how our morality might be impacted by our interactions with AI. What about ethics and morality for AI itself? We might want it to be able to, if it's going to drive us around, we might want it to make not only sort of traffic rule based choices, but ethical choices, right? About, you know, whether to protect a passenger or to protect the, you know, the person who's crossing the street in front of us. Can you actually program an ethics or a morality, especially given that, after all, those are contested in human communities?
You know, my view is that we probably want to avoid having AI systems make any kind of value-laden decision, in part because there are so many nuances and differences across humanity itself. So, you know, what might be acceptable to one person might not be in another situation. And these, you know, morally complicated decisions are complicated for a reason. There's a lot of like sophisticated trade-offs that we're doing when we make these decisions. And so we're definitely nowhere close to having an AI system that would be capable or that should be making decisions like that. You know, another concern, so some people suggest that using something like reinforcement learning that we talked about at the beginning, maybe we build an AI system that we train kind of like our children, and then it starts to learn our values. But even that is kind of concerning, given that human values really aren't that great. So you don't have to look very far into human history to see that we don't treat each other very well. And in fact, we don't treat other creatures very well either. You know, to the extent that we would even want a system that behaves like we do, that might be concerning if that system then encodes our values in a way that prevents or blocks our own moral progress. Furthermore, if a system, you know, was programmed, let's say hypothetically, to bring about world peace or to stop climate change or some goal that in principle sounds like a really good goal, that also might end up having quite negative consequences for us humans. Because if you think about it, we are the main cause of climate change. And we're probably the main cause of sort of violence and aggression in general and pain to others than any other species, right? The harm that we've done to this world, to other species, sort of outweighs anything that any other species has done. So we also want to make sure that an AI values us, or at least plausibly for many of us, we'd want to make sure that the AI does value us and doesn't try to reach those goals without us being involved in them.
Are there key lessons that we should be learning from our conversation, not only ours, but our broader global conversation about AI right now.
One important lesson to draw is that people are interested in sentience. People are interested in knowing what things are sentient and what things aren't and why. And as I said earlier, sentience, I think, quite likely means something like phenomenal consciousness or refers to our conscious experience. And so one lesson is that we ought to be devoting more resources to studying and understanding consciousness, as well as understanding sort of benchmarks for how we assess the level or presence of sentience or consciousness in other creatures.
Dr. Karina Vold is assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology. Thank you so much for this wide-ranging conversation and for your time.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Great to talk to you.